We have with us on line one a gentleman that we've been fortunate to have on the show previously. Always enjoy having him on to talk about a lot of the hot button topics in the world of sports media. There was just a huge banquet a week ago here. We covered it at thefdhlounge.com as our New York Bureau Steve Servillo was in attendance here as he was going over the Sports Business Awards, and we had a recap of that. That will certainly be one of the things we talk about here tonight with Eric Fisher of SBJ. Welcome to the show, Eric. Good to have you back on. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm well. Thanks again.
It's great to have you back on. Let's start with that, I guess. Last week's big annual banquet that you had there and the awards, and it was very interesting to me as I was reading the nominees in the different categories and who some of the winners were. I imagine that this always is a point of fascination every year as the envelopes are getting opened and the honorees are getting crowned.
Yep, this has really grown into a big event for us in fairly short order. What we were basically looking to do 3 years ago when we started putting this together is have an event that basically would be the sports industry version of the Oscars. Within the sports industry, there are previously and still are certain events like the sports Emmys, some technical awards, things that are within specific disciplines, but there had been nothing that really cut across the entire industry to honor things like media, like facility, teams, leagues, sports marketers, specific events. So we were looking for something pandemic across the entire industry, and in three short years we've put together something that we're very thrilled and gratified has been met with a great deal of acceptance.
Well, you know, you've certainly done that, and again, the depth of the categories and the breadth, very interesting. As I was eyeballing them, again, I wouldn't say that there were too many great surprises necessarily, aside from, this was very interesting, Top Professional Sports Team of 2009, your nominees that came up short in this category, the Washington Capitals, Philadelphia Phillies, New Orleans Saints, my Cleveland Cavaliers, and the winner, the Seattle Sounders of MLS. Was that basically a big shock to everybody there, or were they aware of criteria that maybe some of the rest of us might not be?
Well, there was definitely some audible gasps in the room. It is fair to say that it was a bit of a surprise. It's also definitely fair to say that that was one of the most difficult and most hotly contested categories in the entire program. All five of those nominees do fantastic work in their local communities and within their own sports, and they're just great organizations top to bottom. You know, but the thing with the Sounders, which is really interesting, in just over a year, they've completely redefined the metrics of what it means to be a successful American-based soccer team. You know, MLS is in its, I believe, 15th season now, and for pretty much their entire history, they've had these kind of hockey and basketball kind of crowds. You know, high teens, you know, maybe low to mid-20s in some of the bigger markets and for some of the bigger events, and they've had this nice, steady, slow, continuous growth, and they've been building on this steady march. Sounders come in right off the bat, they're getting low to mid-30s, you know, with much of that contracted on season ticket basis. Huge battery sponsorships, one of the biggest jersey deals in the league, and they've just completely come in and had a completely different paradigm as to what it means, again, to be successful playing soccer in America. And that's a big part of what they were honored for.
Well, you know, I'm very intrigued when you talk about some of the business support behind the team and those type of aspects to it, because I've always theorized from afar that Seattle was first and foremost a basketball city, the way that they clasped the Sonics to their hearts, and that all things being equal, much like my hometown of Cleveland, all things being equal, the Browns would always be the biggest. I always thought of the Sonics that way for Seattle. With them having been ripped out of there in that way, is there a sense that, yes, they have baseball, they have football, they love both of those, but there was always a sense also, I think, that Seattle was kind of a dormant soccer town, a town that might have been a good candidate to embrace a team like this. Is there a sense of the Sounders really kind of stepping in and filling that void in the town's heart in any way?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I asked Todd Lewicki that very question shortly after he got the award. He's the chief executive of the team, as to whether there was any sort of, you know, direct nexus between the Sonics and the Sounders, and he doesn't think so, because they were talking about trying to make a play for soccer before the Sonics even left town, and a lot of what they were trading on, to your point, is the international basis of Seattle. That, you know, because of where it is, obviously it doesn't get a lot of East Coast based media attention, but there's all sorts of different nationalities and cultures that are represented in that town, you know, many of which are, you know, soccer-based nations, soccer-based cultures, and so they really came in much like Los Angeles has done with the Galaxy, with a really nice head start, and again have done great things in their short time there.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, that you posed more or less the same question to him. Yeah, that really is kind of food for thought there. Something that kind of grabs me also as I'm looking at this here tonight, and I guess really there is some kind of bleed over between some of our segments that we've done on the show. We had on earlier tonight our good friend who's very much wired into the technology world, Simon Applebaum, and we were talking about aspects with him of how this Google TV thing is going to play, and I'm looking at some of the different categories here. You have some categories that are very closely related to technology here. There was a best in sports technology category, best in sports media, which I'm assuming, you know, encompassed the digital realm as well here. Was there any kind of a buzz last week at this thing with Google TV having burst out onto the scene here of how this may transform the industry in the next year, two, or three with the growing, you know, mainstream merger of internet and TV on the same screen?
Well, just to be clear on the awards program, what we were honoring was accomplishments during calendar year 2009.
Yes.
I think actually technically speaking,
yes,
the nomination time period for which we were judging was,
sure,
December 08 through the Super Bowl, through,
okay,
early February of 10. So Google TV wouldn't have been part of that conversation specifically.
Sure.
Having said all of that, I can just tell you that even within the last 30 to 90 days, digital TV overlays, and by that I mean any sort of means, whether it's a Roku or a Boxy or this Google TV, any sort of way to bring internet-based content to the TV to enjoy on the bigger screen, it's a huge thing coming forward to basically have that kind of control and flexibility to get the kind of programming that wouldn't necessarily be coming through your standard cable operator or satellite operator. Google's a big player, but they're only one player. There are a lot of folks, a lot of distributors, a lot of content owners that are all looking at this very carefully, because now that the bandwidth has improved, the screens have improved, and the technology is there to port this content directly from the internet to the TV at very high quality, the lid's basically about to blow off on this.
Oh, exactly. And I'm glad you clarified the parameters on that, but I think you did glean what I was asking there in terms of the buzz about this thing. I'm not really surprised that there was a lot of buzz, at the conference, because this having just burst out onto the scene as well. I'd also like to ask you in terms of anything that you might have picked up in terms of a buzz or a mood at this conference here. I think it was the first time we had you on the program. It was in the aftermath of when this whole financial crisis really started back in late 08, and we seem to be at another crisis moment here. How bad it's going to be, nobody really knows yet, but with everything we've been hearing and seeing in the last 2 weeks or so with this debt contagion and questions of how it's going to spread, was there any kind of a sense of retrenchment at this thing here of, you know, we've started to have maybe a little bit of an uptick in the last year, but things are about to get bad again, or was there optimism pervading regardless? What were you picking up, or was it kind of a mixed mood?
No, there really wasn't a whole lot of discussion about that specifically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a more general sense, I think, you know, lessons learned from the latter chunk of 08 and the early part of 09 are not soon to be forgotten, that there's still, even as things seemingly get a little better, there's still a heavy focus on hardcore sales fundamentals in this business, really fundamental blocking and tackling. And, you know, I don't see a lot of what I would call, you know, irrational spending or conspicuous consumption. I think again, even as things sort of improve a little bit, I think people remain cognizant and chastened of what happened. If that answers your question.
Sure. Well, you know, in terms of them being chastened and in terms of them having absorbed whatever lessons, and again, one of the things you really heard in all of the spate of analysis when the downturn really started was just about what a consumer-driven society we are and about how we really kind of stand out from the rest of the world in that way with the voracious nature that our people just buy and buy and buy. And, of course, we've seen that diminished over the course of the last 18 months here. So if there's going to be another big hit put on that, even beyond what's happened in the last 18 months, what do you think the trickle down is going to be to the industry here? I mean, surely first and foremost, the ad dollars are going to dry up even more, one would think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say, you know, there's that, and I would say sort of part B of this whole conversation, we're still looking at the potential of two of the four major leagues, you know, staring down the barrel of potentially major work stoppages, you know, with the NBA and the NFL. Both are, you know, still miles apart ideologically as to where their economic models should be situated, you know, in terms of players and management. So, you know, there's that whole issue too. And, you know, if one of these leagues go out for an extended period of time, as we learned from hockey and baseball, you know, people will move on to other things and they'll find other ways to spend their dollars and spend their time, and it's only going to be, and as we did see from baseball and hockey, it only took a multi-year concerted effort to bring those fans back. You know, and maybe that doesn't necessarily even happen again so quickly or so strongly as it did in those sports. So, you know, all of your economic concerns, they're definitely still out there and shared by plenty of people, but this labor situation is sort of, you know, part B of that whole discussion.
Well, you know, and it's a very sour mood in the country anyways here, too. It's a really kind of populist hour, you know, in this country as far as people being mad and as far as not having much of a tolerance for some of the games that, you know, the rich people are playing. So I wonder how it's going to, you know, impact. You mentioned two of the four leagues. I'll raise you one. I think the NHL could potentially be on the verge as well. And even MLB, they're going to be coming up in the next year or two with their thing. Now, again, they've had to learn a very harsh lesson about what happens when you reach the brink, but even they can't be ruled out. You're looking at potentially three or four of these leagues reaching that kind of a brink in a very tough economic climate in this country, because I don't think anybody is going to go out there and say that it's going to get drastically better in the country in the next 2 to 3 years. So what does that do to the landscape if you overlay these very, you know, dire labor situations on top of a sports populace out there that's really not going to be in a mood for it at all?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I don't necessarily share your pessimism on baseball, though. There's definitely their deal comes up after next year, so we'll start to see some serious bargaining in that sport begin next spring. And there's definitely serious issues that they've got to discuss. Draft is a definite big one. Revenue sharing is another big one. But the issues that they have are more refinements within the existing system. They're not talking cosmic, you know, one side seeing black, another seeing white, like it is in football and basketball. And that's the difference that I see. That you know, there are issues of which there are always going to be some in any CBA situation. Baseballs are just not as cosmic. And in the case of hockey, you know, same sort of thing. I mean, they've basically come off, since the strike, the best 4-year run in their history, and I'm seeing pretty good, I expect pretty good TV numbers with Chicago and Philadelphia in the finals here. You know, they're making for their sport too much money, I think, to upset the gravy train, I think, at this point. I could be wrong on that one, but I'm seeing good things for hockey too, and they just signed Bridgestone today, actually, in fact, for 5 more years in a big sponsorship that will include entitlement for the Winter Classic for these next 5 years.
Oh, interesting. Well, that's obviously a significant financial deal for them. One of the things that I've noticed here, Eric, in the different sports. And this seems to be a constant, especially in the sports that are fraying along these fault lines of large market, small market. One of the things that seems to make it hardest to make a deal is you're looking at almost like a triangle type of dynamic in this sense. It's not a straight owners v. players type thing. You've got the large market owners, the small market owners, and the players. And in a sense, the large market owners might as well be on the same side as the players. George Steinbrenner pretty much wants the ability to do whatever he wants, or the other Steinbrenners, you know what I mean. But anyways, you have that in all of the sports here. The ones that are at the top of the pyramid on the ownership scale, essentially it seems to me, want the same thing as the players. So it seems that makes it very, very hard to come to a deal, because it's hard for a commissioner really in any of these sports to unify his own side to go in there and discuss things with the players.
Yeah, that's definitely the case, particularly in football, where, you know, I would submit the degrees of differentiation are even more pronounced than they are now in baseball. You've got a situation where, you know, Dallas, Washington, now the Jets and Giants, with their new stadium coming online, they're in a vastly different kind of scenario than a Jacksonville or even a New Orleans, or, you know, even with their title, some of these teams, Cincinnati, you know, their markets are so different. Their stadium revenues are so different. You know, your point is very well taken that, you know, it's hard to have full consensus, you know, on the situation. But I would also say a big part of what's going on with, you know, with football is that the players are asking for 60-61% of every dollar that the sport generates before any other bills are paid, and the owners, you know, don't want the figure to be that high. I mean, I'm sort of oversimplifying, because the issues are very complex and they go a lot further than that. Rookie pay is another big issue, but you know, that gets back to my prior point as to the fundamental issue in that sport is that you know, there is a very, very basic and fundamental disagreement in that sport as to how the largest of the pie is cut at that most basic level, and that's, you know, nothing but trouble sort of emanates from that, and that's the core issue that they've got to figure out. But again, your large market, small market point within that only amplifies the point.
And you know what? And I'd like to ask you a follow up on that, because again, that's by far the most apocalyptic labor situation looming in sports because of the dominant place that the NFL finds itself on the landscape here. There was a pessimistic premise I had that when we had Alex Marvez on the show, he didn't agree with it. I'd like to see whether you agree or whether you disagree with it. I'm seeing a little bit of a parallel here in the sense that Major League Baseball, they've been locked into this whole Pete Rose banishment since 89, because there's been the sense, I think, that you're dishonoring Bart Giamatti to open the case here. There's been that perception anyways that the image of him almost was kind of as a martyr of the situation there. The death of Bart Giamatti at a bare minimum has complicated bringing Pete Rose back into baseball. I question whether there might be a parallel with Gene Upshaw here. Gene Upshaw always said there will be no return to a cap if there is an uncapped year. So if you're the players, you know, and they've doubled down on that point of view, how do you not look like you're selling out Gene Upshaw's memory to go back on that? Now, Alex Marvez said, look, you get into this whole thing here, players start missing paychecks, the notion of worrying about dishonoring Gene Upshaw goes out the window. So how do you see this here? Have the players backed themselves into a corner that they can't get out of, or are they going to be prepared to get out of that corner if need be?
Yeah, I see where he's coming from, and I would agree, and that's actually the case that we saw from basketball, and that's why, you know, David Stern is in part why he's put up the kind of record he has in labor situations over the years, that at the end of the day, you know, owners are, you know, going to have more money than players. And with players, that's very much what happened in the 99 situation in basketball, when these players were missing checks and started running out of personal funds. That's where trouble was, you know, came in. And this is, you know, again, sort of speaks off on a tangent here, but kind of speaks to the great job that Marvin Miller and Donald Fehr have done over the years, because they really sort of trailblazed the way in terms of getting these war chests together and have that. And, you know, the football players are much better prepared for that now. But having said that, you know, I see where Alex is coming from. It, you know, that war chest gets depleted and these guys start losing money, there's definitely going to be a push, at least on some subsection of that group, to try to find a way to make a deal sooner rather than later.
Well, and I do see that side of the coin. It is an interesting devil's advocate perspective, definitely. Eric, again, just it's a pleasure to have you on. I'd like to give you a chance to plug here anything you'd like to with Sports Business Journal. You had this great conference here. I know you've got some other really great ones coming up, the IMG Sports Marketing Symposium, Sports Media and Technology, Motorsports Marketing. You've got some great things coming up with that later in the year. People, of course, can follow everything you're doing at sportsbusinessjournal.com, which we have linked to off of our rundown here tonight, and also on our Ultimate Links page, as well as the hard copy of Sports Business Journal. And anything that I neglected to mention, please go ahead and put it out there.
Yeah, we've got all those great events that you mentioned coming up in the fall, and I really do appreciate you making mention of those. Summer is, we don't do any of those events during the summer for pretty obvious reasons with vacations and all that. More immediately, though, in probably late July to early August, we haven't nailed down a specific date. We are looking to have a new online presence for both Sports Business Journal and our sister outlet, Sports Business Daily. Been working pretty hard on that over the last year or so. And it's really going to help provide a new look for, obviously, this new digital-focused media landscape in which we operate, and have something much more robust, immersive, and contemporary. So we're really looking forward to that.
Oh, that's tremendous. As we have, again, both of your sites that you mentioned there, sportsbusinessjournal.com, sportsbusinessdaily.com, linked off of our rundown here tonight and our Ultimate Links page. Great content there. Eric, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show, and we've had Abe Madcore on, and it's been a pleasure to have him on. You guys are always covering some of the most fascinating things going on out there. Truly a pleasure to have you on. We look forward to doing it again here at some point, Eric.
Not a problem. My pleasure.
Thank you so much, Eric. Eric Fisher.
All right, take care.
Thank you so much from sportsbusinessjournal.com.